Hi, boys and girls. Like you, Santa is listening to the Merry Little Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
Merry Christmas and welcome to yet another edition of the Merry Little Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com. We are the Internet's longest ongoing celebration of Christmas, dating all the way back to 1991. My name is Jeff Westover, and I am the head eggnog tester at the Merry Forums of My Merry Christmas, the world's greatest Christmas community where the talk of Christmas continues year-round. Our sponsor of this episode is ChristmasPodcast.com. Home of the Christmas Podcast Podcast, a weekly review of newly released Christmas podcasts from all over the internet. Christmas Podcast showcases hundreds of podcast episodes, all about every kind of Christmas you can imagine. Come check out the available episodes online at ChristmasPodcast.com. The post-Civil War era was progressive in so many ways, and Christmas was caught up in the middle of it. Everything about Christmas evolved. The trees, the shopping, the decorating, the celebrating, all of it moved forward in many interesting ways. This time around, we're going to discuss the stuff of Christmas in the 1870s, the 1880s, and the 1890s, and this, our final installment on the Victorian Christmas. Christmas was, as you recall, declared officially a holiday in the United States in 1870. It was an event marked by absolutely no one, and, frankly, it was forgotten by all in the years shortly thereafter. In fact, it only gets a mention now because people today think that that declaration was a big deal. It wasn't. And why? Because Christmas was already being celebrated and nobody needed the government to declare it. What did happen in the 1870s was an explosion in Christmas popularity. What you're hearing is music written in the 1850s titled Santa Claus Christmas Symphony. It employs jingle bells, slap percussion to simulate the sound of a whip, and it's all in a 26-minute creation that has somehow fallen into the dustbin of history. It was written by an American composer named William Henry Fry, who claimed in 1853 when he wrote it that it was, quote, the longest instrumental composition written on a single subject with unbroken continuity, unquote. Borrowing at times from familiar tunes like Adeste Fideles, the work is surprisingly festive, easy to listen to, and yes, so very easy to identify with Santa Claus. We've linked the entire thing to a YouTube video on the show notes for this episode so that you can hear the whole thing. It's worthy of note that this masterpiece was written and performed before Jingle Bells and Up on the Housetop and Jolly Old St. Nicholas, all later songs that captured the public's imagination about Santa Claus. So why didn't this classical composition catch on? Well, it's because Fry went on to become a music critic and a newspaper columnist, and he antagonized his contemporaries so greatly that they wouldn't play his stuff. Not even for as great as this is. It has become one of the great forgotten gems of the 19th century, and something we now remember with gratitude. By the time the 1880s came around, we began to see some trends in the newspapers about Christmas, namely nostalgia. Newspapers across the country made it a routine to publish Christmas memories from folks who would reminisce about the old days of Christmas 40 or 50 years before. These are fun and heartwarming stories, and they give us a lot of detail about what it meant to be a child in the 1840s and 1850s during Christmas time. Many of these stories tell of seeing a Christmas tree for the first time. Some talk of how their parents would put up the tree after the children had hung their stockings and gone to bed, so that they had a double surprise of both Santa and the Christmas tree the next morning. And without exception, it was the tree that was the top memory. Christmas Day seemed to contain universal elements. It was, at first, a day of church, then a day of fun, and then a day of feasting. Snow play was memorable for the kids living in the North, while fireworks were the rage in the South, well, at least amongst the boys.
I bought a top for Tommy, a dresser set for Mommy, a little baby doll for Linda Ruth, a bracelet for Susanna, for Jim a new bandana, and baby George gets a new front tooth. We're shopping almost over, my list I'm going over, I found a name that made my heart pause. We're shopping almost done, I forgot to check this one, I forgot to remember Santa Claus, I forgot to remember Santa Claus, the jolly little man in his red suit. I forgot to remember Santa Claus, the man that comes around in his black boots. I'm so glad I remembered him today, for Santa I'll go shopping right away. Before your shopping's done, sure and check this one, don't forget to remember Santa Claus. Don't forget to remember Santa Claus, the jolly little man in his red suit. Don't forget to remember Santa Claus, the man that comes around in his black boots. I'm so glad I remembered him today, for Santa I'll go shopping right away. Before your shopping's done, you be sure and check this one, don't forget to remember Santa Claus.
One of the unheralded trends of not only Christmas, but just life in the 1880s was the community building that happened because of the local newspaper. Where news was once shared from one market to the next, it started in the 1880s to become more personal to each community. Publications, especially in larger cities, began to generate enough revenue and subscriber bases to actually have reporters and staff who could get out into the community and ask people's opinions. And that usually resulted in very unique features that reflected local angles and trends of the times in specific locations. For example, the Evening World of New York City published an article about Christmas cards on the 21st of December, 1888. A reporter ventured into the city and interviewed dealers of Christmas cards. He was shocked to find out that Christmas cards were available in wide varieties and priced from 3 cents each to $25 for a single card. One card the reporter found fascinating was what was called a fruit panel. A large card featured grapes on a plush panel. The dealer explained, quote, "The grapes are made of rubber and are not as delicate as the wax variety, although they are more natural in appearance. They can be squeezed without injury," unquote. The article goes on to explain the various cards available, what they were made of, and how they were crafted. The dealer said, quote, "The demand for Christmas cards increased so of late years that I have been compelled to double my stock, and now have on hand nearly $15,000 worth of every size and variety," unquote. The stunning thing about the information in this article is how much was being spent on Christmas cards in 1888. If $7 was the average price in 1888, as that article indicated, that is the equivalent of $190 in today's money. So it's no wonder that these cards are still considered collectibles nearly 150 years later. On the same page as that article in the Evening World are a number of letters to the editor about Christmas. Many of them were simple donations of $4 or so to be donated to, quote, fill a Christmas stocking for a child in need. It could be said that the local newspapers were the social media of their day. In them, folks wrote to the editors to convey Christmas memories and to share, well, Christmas frustrations. News, of course, of Christmas trends was spread, but so too were stories of legend and explanation of Christmas traditions. It was, in many ways, a very conversational thing between the community newspaper and the community. Newspapers were not always glowing in their reporting of Christmas either. From the New York Times of 28 December 1881 came this bitter opinion about Christmas giving, quote, "There is no doubt that in its origin the custom of giving Christmas presents was purely benevolent. Charitable people gave food to the hungry and trousers to the ragged as the best way of celebrating the Christmas season. It was not long, however, before the circle of Christmas beneficiaries was widened and men began to give unnecessary and purely complimentary gifts to their wives and sisters. This was, so to speak, the middle age of Christmas giving. Men gave without hope of receiving gifts themselves, and the early women who worked the first pairs of pastoral slippers had no thought of gaining anything more than the approbation of their own consciences. A steady increase in the value of Christmas gifts made by men to women has been in progress during the last century, while the value of gifts made by women to men has remained nearly stationary. A man with a large circle of relatives is often compelled to approach the verge of bankruptcy when Christmas arrives, and prudent young men will no longer marry girls who have an excess of sisters. A few years ago, an attempt was made by cunning financiers to introduce an irredeemable paper currency of Christmas cards. These were, of course, inexpensive, and if substituted for bracelets and bonnets and diamonds, they would effect an enormous savings. It was estimated at that time, 1876, that the average amount expended on Christmas gifts by each male American was $7.37, and that this amount could be reduced to 37 cents only by the introduction of Christmas cards. The scheme failed because there was no authority which could force the Christmas card paper into circulation and retire the bracelets and the diamonds. In fact, the scheme recoiled upon its own inventors. It simply added a new expense to the ordinary Christmas outlay for wicked stationers who manufactured costly Christmas cards, and men are now compelled to give away these cards in addition to their other gifts," unquote. Women in the newspapers, too, had their complaints about men in gift giving. From 1879 came this candid poem. "Ah, how can you speak so cross, Charlie? It isn't kind or right. You wouldn't have talked a year ago as you have done tonight. You wonder to see me sit and cry like a baby vexed, you say, when you didn't know I wanted a gift, nor think about the day. But I'm not a baby, Charlie, crying for something fine. Only a loving woman pain could shed such tears as mine. For every Christmas time till now, and that is why I grieve. It was you that wanted to give, Charlie, more than I to receive. And I would not have cared tonight, Charlie, how poor the gift or small, had you only brought me something to show that you thought of me at all. The merest trifle of any kind that I could keep or wear, a flimsy bit of lace for my neck or a ribbon for my hair. A pretty story of lovers true, or a book of pleasant rhyme, a flower or holly branch to mark the blessed Christmas time. But to be forgotten, Charlie, 'tis that brings the tear, and just to think that I have been your wife but a single year." It is interesting to note the changing dynamics of relationships in men and women through the eyes of Christmas during the 19th century. It is known as such an uptight time, a time of great sensibilities and almost rigid morals, and yet Christmas seemed to bring out the imperfections in everyone. In many news reports, the whole rabid fad of Christmas cards really got to people in the 1880s. Another newspaper in Rochester, New York in 1885 was entirely convinced that Christmas cards was a fad that had run its course. In a 23rd of December article in 1885, a local dealer said in the paper, quote, "The Christmas cards sold this year are largely left over from last year. There are a few new designs, but Rochester's merchants have bought sparingly of them. I think next year will be the last one of the Christmas card," unquote. The article went on to say, quote, "The term Christmas Day has come to be almost synonymous, you might say, with giving, and a card is not considered a present. I think the opinion is becoming general that cards should be given at Easter and not at Christmas. Then again, it may be that Christmas cards have lost their popularity because many designs become so cheap and common. One person doesn't like to purchase what everyone else is buying, and it has become almost impossible to find a card different from what someone already else has." Christmas cards trended differently in various areas of the country. Searches reveal a greater number of mentions of Christmas cards in the Midwest versus the Eastern U.S. during the 1880s for some reason. Most of this was accounted for in ads. It just seems more types of stores stocked Christmas cards in the Midwest during the decade of the 1880s. Even still, there was plenty of advice and opinions from the newspapers. From the Salina, Kansas Republican of December 30th, 1887 came this bit of advice, quote, "The average man regards the Christmas card with despair. He does not like to throw it away. He does not want it about the room, and he has not thought to tie his Christmas cards up in a box and send them to some foundling children's hospital. One had very much better send on Christmas morning a few bonbons prettily tied with ribbon, a dainty calendar, or almost any little thing, than a beribboned, befringed, and milnered edition of a Christmas card. They are neither artistic or useful, and have no reason in the world for existence. When they were simple little cards costing from 5 to 25 cents and flew on the wings of the postman wishing one's friend well, then there was some sentiment in them. But now they are simply representative of 2, 3, sometimes 10, sometimes $25 worth of wasted money. Take my advice, O giver of gifts, and send something that will be enjoyed," unquote. That article, of course, was written by a man.
I sure do like those Christmas cookies, sugar. I sure do like those Christmas cookies, babe. The ones that look like Santa Claus, Christmas trees and bales of stars. I sure do like those Christmas cookies, babe.
Now Christmas cookies are a special treat. The more she bakes, the more I eat. And sometimes I can't get myself to stop.
Mm-hmm, I know what you mean there, Phil.
Sometimes she'll wait till I'm asleep to take the ones I didn't eat and put those little sprinkly things on top. What do you think about it, Joe?
I sure do like those Christmas cookies, sugar. I sure do like those Christmas cookies, babe. The ones that look like Santa Claus.
The history of cookies and Christmas tends to be pretty complicated, if not mysterious, to historians for some reason. At least if what you read of them online about cookies is to be believed, but it's really not all that complicated. The cookie was associated from the earliest times of the Christmas tree as a means of decoration, and of course symbolism. The cookie was representative of the flesh of Christ. Cookies were used, as were other foods like apples and other fruits, in decorating a Christmas tree, each piece in its own way contributing to the symbolism and the education of the nativity story. Ornaments made of food were common through the first half of the 19th century. How cookies became associated with Santa Claus isn't that complicated either. As most trees were made on Christmas Eve, or decorated rather on Christmas Eve, and most cookies were too, over time it became a custom to leave a little something out for Santa and the reindeer when they visited. Remember, this was the Victorian era, a time of propriety, manners, and thinking of others. It was, at the end of a long Christmas Eve day, just the right thing to do, to leave cookies for Santa. Cookies in those days were much more prized than they are today. It was not uncommon for children to arise in the morning on Christmas to see some of those same cookies gifted back to them from good old Santa Claus in their stockings. And who else other than Santa Claus could put them there? The things in the stocking were something of note as well. Perhaps the most common thing found was homemade molasses candy. In many areas of the country, folks were just too poor to do much of anything else. It's common to read of children in the 1850s sharing memories of Christmases they could remember and sharing those stories in newspapers in the 1880s and 1890s. These stories often tell of catching mothers in tears, stuffing stockings with humble gifts of molasses candy and maybe a new penny and some leftover cookies. More fortunate children, those who perhaps live closer to the larger cities and who were a little more well-to-do, they might see a small toy, a doll, a tin horn, or if they were really lucky, maybe a penknife. It might be the big gift that they found in their stockings to go with all the candy, nuts, and fruit that was used as filler. The making of cookies, then and now, was an event, usually marked by visiting Grandma on what was known as Baking Day, when all the treats of Christmas were made together. Many shared that as a common memory of Christmas.
Mary's in the kitchen, it's Christmas Eve, whipping up a redneck recipe. She calls the eggnog delight and serves it with pork rind. Amos drinks it up, now it's party time. We'll do the eggnog boogie, the eggnog boogie. You last year, Amos fell into the Christmas tree, doing the eggnog boogie on a Christmas Eve. You'll do the eggnog boogie,
the eggnog boogie,
the eggnog boogie,
the eggnog boogie.
Amos swinging like Elvis round the Christmas tree, doing the eggnog boogie on a Christmas Eve.
As we have noted in the past, the tradition of American eggnog dates all the way back to the original settlers in Jamestown in 1607. Some historians say the tradition stems from the Old English practice of wassailing, but there is actual little proof that that is true. But no matter its origin, eggnog was both a tradition of holiday fare and of Christmas socializing. The tradition only seemed to pick up speed during the Victorian era of Christmas. What made it so popular was not only its delicious, unique flavor, but also the fact that it was, by and large, an alcoholic diversion that was looked upon with a wink and a smile. This is no small matter of fact. Alcohol was increasingly frowned upon during the Victorian era in both England and the USA, as they were undergoing all kinds of social reform during this time frame. For many, that time in history is kind of known for its priggishness on issues such as alcohol use. Eggnog, like wassail in England, defied absolute definition by way of a recipe. The most common ingredients were eggs, milk or cream, sugar, nutmeg, and rum. To make it, most recipes recommended separating the egg yolks from the egg whites. First, the yolks were beaten and combined with all the other ingredients, then the egg whites were beaten and added to the mix. It was then served, usually after it had been chilled. There are variations of both hot and cold eggnog. Some served it over cracked ice. In the 1890s, there was something of an eggnog fad of serving frozen eggnog. Of course, containing as much alcohol as it customarily did, it never truly froze, but it became rather more like an eggnog custard. Eggnog also was not just a Christmas thing alone in the second half of the 19th century. Easter, believe it or not, was another popular time for eggnog. But for many folks, especially in the south portions of the country, they counted eggnog as a big Christmas tradition, as, well, almost as big as turkeys and pumpkin pie. Then, like now, these flavors were all together associated with great Christmas celebration. But let's be honest. The hook behind eggnog was the alcohol. And while brandy, different kinds of whiskeys, and even wine, in some cases, were added to eggnog, by far, the most consistent alcoholic element mentioned throughout the entire 19th century was rum, and specifically Jamaican rum. Now, that was a curiosity to me, and researching the history of Jamaican rum, I ended down a rabbit hole of fascinating history overall. Sugarcane was introduced shortly after Columbus arrived in 1492, and within a fairly short amount of time, the sugar industry was thriving in the Caribbean, and in Brazil, and in Mexico. One of the sticky byproducts of sugar production is molasses, and nobody really knew what to do with it. Some was fed to slaves and livestock, and some was mixed with lime and horsehair to make mortar, and some was used to concoct a very ineffective treatment for syphilis. Most of it, however, to the tune of millions of gallons a year, was simply tossed into the sea. No one really knows who first noticed that molasses could be fermented to generate alcohol, but the breakthrough may have occurred on Barbados, a tiny pear-shaped island at the tail end of the Lesser Antilles. There, in 1647, a chatty visitor named Richard Ligon attended a party at which he was treated to a feast that included a suckling pig, pineapple, and a throat-searing drink known as Kill Devil, an early moniker for rum. Even the authoritative Oxford English Dictionary tosses up its hands when it comes to the origin of the word rum. But best guess is that it's a shortened version of rumbullion or rumbustion, also of obscure origin, both old British slang terms for uproar, which may have been the inevitable result of, well, drinking rum. Though undeniably alcoholic, the original rum doesn't seem to have been all that tasty. Even the perennial upbeat Ligon describes it as, quote, not very pleasant, unquote. More forthright critics called it rough and disagreeable or hot, hellish, and terrible, and nevertheless it sold like hotcakes. Pirates traditionally accounted for a lot of it. Excavations at Port Royal, Jamaica, a famous pirate hangout once dubbed the wickedest city of the world, turned up thousands of rum bottles. By the 18th century, American colonists were not only importing rum, they were distilling their own. As of 1770, according to Wayne Curtis, there were over 150 rum distilleries in New England alone, and the colonists collectively were importing 6.5 million gallons of the West Indian molasses and turning it into 5 million gallons of rum. One estimate from the time of the Revolutionary War puts American rum consumption at nearly 4 gallons per person per year. Unfortunately, most of it wasn't very good, but it did have the advantage of being cheap and very widely available. Eggnog was just a variant of rum consumption and made it taste better.
Gobble, gobble, chop, chop. Gobble, gobble, chop, chop. Gobble, gobble, chop, chop. Gobble, gobble, chop, chop.
Frank the Christmas turkey is not himself tonight. He won't go near the eggnog, seems a bit uptight. Keeps looking out the window, says he wants to leave. Don't be a party pooper, Frank, it's Christmas Eve.
Gobble, gobble, chop, chop. Gobble, gobble, chop, chop.
Everybody's singing, full of Christmas cheer. But he's over in the corner, trembling with fear. He wandered in the kitchen when the party first began. Saw a box of stuffing, an empty roasting pan. So let all the jingle bells ring. Frankie won't feel a thing. We'll gobble you down as we bid you adieu. Then pull on your wishbone till it breaks in two.
We forget that traditional foods of 150 years or so ago might have been the same that we celebrate with today, but that doesn't mean they were exactly the same. Take, for example, the Christmas turkey. Yes, that was the centerpiece of the feast, and the pumpkin pie, even, or I should say especially, was the topper of the feast. But the turkey and the pumpkin pie weren't exactly the same as we know it today. The turkey in most cases didn't come from a butcher or from a market. It usually came from a farm or was hunted from the wild. Listen to this direction from an Ohio newspaper from 1885. Quote, authorities differ in their opinions regarding the best method of preparing the noble bird for roasting, some contending that it should not be stuffed, but simply trussed and thus roasted. All, however, agree on one point, that the bird should be hung at least a week before dressing, if the weather be at all suitable. Unquote. We forget that the agrarian society of the 19th century meant most Christmas turkeys arrived at the home alive. But as in our day, there was a great debate about preparing it, especially in stuffing it. It pleased me to read from the same article that sausage meat mixed with egg was part of the recommended recipe for turkey stuffing. I learned years ago not to tell my kids what was in my stuffing. It's the world's simplest ingredients, and they are just perfect in combination with all the other flavors of a roast turkey. But they include sage sausage and raw eggs, just as in the days of the Victorians. I don't, however, have to go out and kill my turkey and let it hang for a week. And for that, I'm very grateful.
Believe what Christmas has come to today. All these atheists and judges trying to take it away. No carols in our public schools, no trees at City Hall. And they wish you season's greetings at the shopping mall. Ain't you sick of it all? Well, there's a war on Christmas, it's under attack. But this year America's taking it back. Separate church and state, that's what some lawyer said. I say it's time we separated him from his head. You can call me unchristian, but that's not true. Cause if I got a present for you, it's a thought that counts.
Rounding out the Victorian era to great acclaim was the letter to the New York Sun from an 8-year-old little girl named Virginia O'Hanlon. And you know the story. She wrote, quote, Papa says, if you see it in the sun, it's so. So please tell me the truth. Is there a Santa Claus? Unquote. Naturally, the editor's reply gained worldwide attention as he assured Virginia that Santa did indeed exist and that the world would be a weary place without both Santas and Virginias. The story of Virginia O'Hanlon and the famous editor's reply was known far and wide in 1897. It was republished in newspapers coast to coast and around the world, and it is just as famous today. But what is not widely known is why all of that was such a big deal in 1897. You see, during the years of around 1896 to about 1900, Santa Claus began to be hotly debated as an idea. In fact, many traditional elements of Christmas, such as the tree and Christmas ornaments and gift giving, were also topics of some debate. You could, in fact, call it, well, a war on Christmas. The Victorian era arguments played right into the sentiments that we think of when considering all things Victorian. It was the righteous and the pious of the time, and that would be the priests and the pastors, the school teachers and the psychologists, who called into question some of the runaway happy elements of what had become, well, the American Christmas. From news reports in 1897 came this, quote, in Philadelphia, some of the kindergarten teachers have stirred up ill feeling among parents by attacking what they call the Santa Claus myth. These young maiden ladies have been so presumptuous in some cases as to lecture the mothers of children on the evils of encouraging belief in our Christmas legends, unquote. A Rochester, New York newspaper reported in December 1898, quote, if the various crank reformers could all have their way, soon there would be nothing left of Christmas. Because certain foolish persons abuse the gracious Christmas custom of giving and make of it a burden and a nuisance to themselves and others, there are those who would abolish the custom. Last year, there was a great to-do about the Christmas tree and Christmas decorations in the church, which were frowned upon by all Christian people because they were heathen in origin. this year, there are murmurings against Santa Claus because, forsooth, there is no such person as Santa Claus, and parents who deceive their children in regard to the existence of Santa Claus are likely to lose respect and confidence of their offspring when they grow old enough to discover the truth. It seems to us that Santa Claus reformers are taking a good deal for granted when they assume as a basis for their argument the non-existence of Santa Claus. We do not assert the actual existence of Santa Claus, but we very much doubt anybody's ability to logically prove his non-existence, unquote. Ironically, from the Sun, the very same newspaper that brought the Virginia O'Hanlon editorial, was another article in 1897 featuring local clergy damning the presence of Santa Claus in the celebration of Christmas. Said the Reverend S. Parks Cadman of the Central Metropolitan Temple, quote, "This year I propose to obliterate Santa Claus and substitute manger exercises and other purely religious features which I am confident will be equally appreciated and enjoyed by the children," unquote. It appears that the movement against Christmas trees and Christmas decorations and Santa Claus between the years 1896 and 1900 was squelched by a media blitz of extra love for Christmas. During those years, while news reports featured debates from educators and clergy, the newspapers seemed to step up their features of Christmas memories, letters to Santa, and features explaining Christmas history, legends, and traditions. In all these last closing years of the Victorian era, Christmas showcases what Christmas has always been in all periods of history. The Victorians had moments where Christmas literally saved the day, where it was a season of light, love, and magic. There were also elements of Christmas, time-honored as proven to bring happiness, that were not equal for all people. Christmas was different for the rich than it was for the poor, but it could be, if so chosen, just as uplifting and just as joyous for all. Christmas accelerated during the Victorian era, and we all, from ocean to ocean and worldwide, became more unified in our love for Christmas during the Victorian era, and more divided over whether it was a time of sacred devotion or secular celebration. That dialogue and those debates endure, perhaps better than any song or any kind of decoration or any type of food that we mark during the holiday season. Join us at the Merry Forums of MyMerryChristmas.com, where we celebrate the many seasons and historical times of Christmas and discuss those debates all year round in every kind of weather and world condition. From all of us at MyMerryChristmas.com, this is Jeff Westover wishing you and yours a very Merry Christmas.